Good morning. Ms. Rasmussen, are you ready to proceed?
I am. Thank you. May it please the Court, Lisa Rasmussen on behalf of Mr. Patterson, the appellant. I raised several issues in this appeal, and probably one of the most substantial is that there's a lack of record, which is particularly handicapping to me because I wasn't trial counsel in this case. One of the lack of record issues that we cite is some 41 unrecorded bench conferences, and it's really problematic. It's problematic to try to preserve Mr. Patterson's rights on appeal, particularly when I wasn't there during the trial. There are also instances where Mr. Patterson himself was not present, and those were at critical stages during the proceedings when the jurors had questions during deliberation. Those issues worked to serve a violation of due process on Mr. Patterson, but that was just the beginning. The larger structural error is a lack of right to retain counsel in this case, with no inquiry whatsoever made by either the Justice Court or the District Court. There is a lack of inquiry with regard to whether a Deno hearing is required. There are so many due process errors in this case that reversal is just necessary. It is mandatory in this case because he has so many overlapping violations of due process.
Ms. Rasmussen, there's a lot of issues that you've just mentioned and have been raised in the briefs, but I was wondering, for me at least, if you could begin by discussing what you perceive to be structural error at the Justice Court level and its consequences.
Thank you. Structural error occurs when it's error per se, and those that has to do with right to counsel issues. A defendant in a criminal case has a right to retain counsel of their choice. Mr. Ogata was retained prior to the preliminary hearing. When he came to the preliminary hearing and said that he had been retained and asked for a short continuance, the Justice Court said no. Certainly courts are entitled to balance the needs of calendar against the rights of a defendant to retain counsel of their choice. However, in this case, there's no inquiry. There is no inquiry of could you be ready in 2 days, could you be ready in 5 days, what is the prejudice to the defendant. There were two defendants in this case. The only thing in the record is the Justice Court's indication that she's not going to bifurcate the preliminary hearing. No further inquiry is made from Mr. Patterson or Mr. Ogata or Mr. Tannery, who is appointed counsel. So that begins the commencement of structural error.
But what exactly did Judge Zaragoza do or not do that, in your mind, created structural error at the Justice Court level?
She did not allow Mr. Ogata, the retained counsel of Mr. Patterson's choice, to represent him at the preliminary hearing.
Tannery continued representing the defendant.
That's correct.
Did Tannery object to once he learned that Ogata had been retained?
Tannery said that he was prepared to go forward. He was appointed through the Office of Appointed Counsel. I don't want to second-guess Mr. Tannery's thought process, but when we're appointed in a case...
I'm just talking about what the record reflects.
The record doesn't reflect any real commentary from Mr. Tannery.
And did Ogata say, I am retained counsel,
yes,
my client has a choice of counsel, if you proceed with this preliminary hearing, you are violating my client's right to choice of counsel. Not right to counsel, right to choice of counsel.
Mr. Ogata did not say that. Mr. Ogata said that he had been retained. He said that he would go forward with the preliminary hearing, but that he needed a brief continuance. He did not make the record I might have made or someone else might have made about the client's choice. He didn't.
Can the right to choice of counsel be waived by Patterson at the Justice Court level?
It can be waived by Patterson, but there would have to be a canvas. It would have to be a canvas of Mr. Patterson.
What's the basis for that?
The basis of it is nobody heard from Mr. Patterson. Mr. Patterson is there represented by ostensibly two lawyers, one appointed, one retained, and the court never made any inquiry of Mr. Patterson as to his choice of counsel to certify or to at least get in the record his choice of retained counsel, Mr. Ogata.
So what I'm trying to focus on, excuse me, Justice Breyer, one further question and I'll stop. I don't mean to be so inquisitive, but this is an important issue from my point of view. So the error, the violation that you maintain occurred, was in the justice court's failure to canvass the defendant when confronted with notice or knowledge that choice of counsel had been made by Patterson.
The error is twofold. That is part of it, the failure to canvass, but also the failure to make any further inquiry and the denial of the right to allow Mr. Ogata to proceed. And the reason why these are structural errors is because we have no way of determining how the proceedings would have been different had we had Mr. Ogata. That's precisely why these are deemed structural errors.
Which leads to my question. Didn't the Justice Court also allow Mr. Ogata to participate as well as Mr. Tanner?
The Justice Court allowed him to sit there, which is...
Was he limited to just sitting there? And that's not my understanding of the record. He was allowed to confer and participate.
My understanding of the record is that he was allowed to confer with Mr. Tannery, but not to cross-examine witnesses. But I think more importantly than that is he was not prepared on that particular day. He could have perhaps been prepared 2 days later or 5 days later. Preliminary hearing, we don't often have the bulk of discovery. So had he had the opportunity to prepare a brief continuance that he was requesting, then he would have been able to meaningfully participate in the proceedings.
Okay, thank you.
And to further that...
So how is this perceived structural error perpetuated in the district court?
Thank you. That was what I was going to talk about. The structural error starts at the justice court. It continues on to the district court when Mr. Tannery says there is retained counsel and there is absolutely no inquiry made by the district court whatsoever as to the status of counsel, whether there's retained counsel. There's no inquiry, further inquiry made of Mr. Tannery other than his sense of perhaps it might be awkward, where is he going to sit when he comes in the room? Because he had apparently sat at counsel table during the preliminary hearing. There's no inquiry or canvas of Mr. Patterson, again, by the district court. There's no inquiry whatsoever. So it begins in the justice court, and it follows through to the district court. I would like to reserve about 5 minutes of my time, and I didn't say that at the onset, so I think that I have probably a couple minutes left, and I'd like to address a couple other issues. With regard to the Deno hearing, the district court was required to actually hold a hearing and to allow testimony from the law enforcement officer, from Mr. Patterson, whoever the defense might wish to present. The district court, in a quite convoluted conclusion, said, I'm just going to let it stand on the justice court record, which really, frankly, doesn't make any sense. There was no justice court inquiry as to the voluntariness of the statement given to the FBI. There was...
But your client didn't request a Deno hearing or an evidentiary hearing, did he?
He filed a motion in limine to preclude the statement. That was the way it came about. It was not a request by trial counsel for an evidentiary hearing. It was a motion in limine. I think that the court...
So you rely on the motion in limine to say that he preserved the request for a Deno hearing?
I do, because the district court had an obligation to make inquiry before the statement went to the jury with regard to the voluntariness of the statement. And whether it was done perfectly or not, I think that the court should have at least had an inquiry process into whether or not the statement was voluntary. Another issue I wanted to raise is the state's repeated vouching for its FBI witness and basically allowing false testimony to go forward that there is no policy. The FBI policy is that we do not record. Repeatedly, that was the answer from the FBI agent. It was the answer that the state allowed to stand on the record, and it is simply not true. It is not true that there is no policy allowing FBI to record. In fact, they're encouraged to record whenever possible. And this was no small issue. The jurors asked several questions about the recording, the lack of recording. They wanted to know why the FBI agent made notes, whether the person had a chance to review them, whether he read them to him. This was a huge issue to the jury. And so to allow the witness to say, we have a policy not to record, was really inaccurate and improper and really bordering on proffering false testimony to the jury in this case. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time if that would be okay.
Thank you, Ms. Rasmussen. For the state, Ms. Morton.
If it pleases the court, my name is Carrie Morton. I'm from the Clark County District Attorney's Office. I represent the state of Nevada, the respondent here. And I'd like to briefly start off where appellant initially started with whether the appellant was denied his right to counsel. I want to point out that at the preliminary hearing, Judge Saragossa did have all of the attorneys approach based on her conversations at the bench. She decided that she was not going to bifurcate the trial or the preliminary hearing and that she wasn't going to continue it. She also found that the state had out-of-state witnesses, that no one had been contacted to try to continue, and that Mr. Tannery was prepared to go forward, as was Mr. Denton's attorney. She allowed Mr. Ogata to sit at counsel table with Mr. Tannery, confer with him, and have any input that he wanted to do.
Was a record made of this bench conference?
Your Honor, I don't believe that a record was made of the bench conference outside of what Judge Saragossa said after the bench conference,
So you're relating what happened at the bench conference isn't contained in the record, is it?
The exact conversation is not. Judge Saragossa just said in conversations.
Well, aren't we limited to considering this? I'm sorry for interrupting you. I didn't mean to do that, but I just wanted to add the question. Aren't we limited to reviewing Judge Saragossa's action on this subject based on what she said?
I think it is what she said, and she does actually go on to say that in the conversations at the bench with all the parties in this case, Mr. Patterson apparently spoke with Mr. Ogata. She goes through the details of the conversations, and then she goes on to say that the state was ready with out-of-state witnesses, and the two defense attorneys were ready. So I think she does kind of go through a few things that were discussed at the bench, and again, she did allow Mr. Ogata to sit at counsel table. I also wanted to point out that...
But it's true she never canvassed the defendant.
Not at the preliminary hearing. She didn't canvass the defendant.
Was she obligated to do so?
Judge, I don't believe that she was obligated to canvass the defendant at that stage. I think she had Mr. Tannery there who was prepared and ready to go forward, and she spoke with Mr. Ogata as well. I think the fact that she spoke with his appointed counsel, I think that was sufficient in this case, and the retained counsel.
Well, are you arguing that by having spoken to Mr. Ogata and at least relaying what the conversation was from the point of view of the judge, that constituted a waiver by the defendant of his choice of counsel?
I don't think it necessarily constituted a waiver because Mr. Ogata did want to substitute in. However, I think that Judge Saragossa, in weighing prejudice to the state and the out-of-state witnesses and the other counsel, felt that it wasn't in the best interest of the entire proceeding.
So you acknowledge that what transpired did not constitute a waiver by the defendant of his choice of counsel, and I assume you acknowledge the judge's decision deprived Ogata's right to participate in the proceeding.
Well, I believe that that it didn't necessarily deprive his right because she did allow him to sit there and confer, and he was provided with discovery before some of the discovery to review.
But you acknowledge that what transpired didn't constitute a waiver of his choice of counsel.
I think at that stage the defendant did not waive his right to have Mr. Ogata represent him. However, in the time since the preliminary hearing, Mr. Ogata never not once tried to confirm his counsel. He never filed a motion. He never appeared at any hearing. He never appeared at the calendar call. Mr. Tannery filed motions, was present at every hearing.
The court is faced with an interesting question. Did what happened at the justice court level constitute structural error, which infected the rest of the proceedings, requiring reversal in this case?
I don't believe it did, Your Honor.
Why not?
At the preliminary hearing stage, the purpose of the preliminary hearing is slighter marginal evidence that a crime was committed and that the defendant committed the crime. Mr. Tannery was appointed. He was qualified. He was prepared to go forward. Mr. Ogata was there present with him. The evidence that needs to be presented at the preliminary hearing stage is so minimal, I think, that in the evidence that was presented, it would have been bound over no matter which attorney had represented him. I think at the trial level, when Mr. Tannery was still representing him, again, I'll briefly say that the district court judge never denied a motion for Mr. Ogata to try to confirm his counsel, because Mr. Ogata never tried to confirm. Although Mr. Ogata did appear...
Well, can harmless error, which is what you seem to be suggesting, overcome a structural error?
Well, Your Honor, at the preliminary hearing stage, I don't believe that it is structural error. I believe if Your Honor finds...
Why not?
Well, because in all of the case law that's cited by counsel and that's cited in this issue, they're dealing with the trial court and the trial of the actual defendant. At the preliminary hearing stage, I think if Your Honor finds that it was error for Judge Zaragoza to not allow Mr. Ogata to substitute in and continue the preliminary hearing, that could be reviewed under a harmless error.
But is there any Sixth Amendment jurisprudence that says it's not structural error if it occurs at the preliminary hearing?
I'm not familiar with any cases in particular. However, I am familiar with the district court cases with the trial where it said that it could be or it can be the structural error.
So, Ms. Morton, please proceed.
The Sixth Amendment right attaches at the time the preliminary hearing occurs.
That's correct. But in this case, there are other cases that say the justice court has, her own agenda or her with the calendar schedules and different issues that the justice court can take into account, and whether she's deciding whether she's going to continue a case and whether it's prejudicial to both sides. So I think Judge Zaragoza made those decisions based on the prejudice and the counsel being ready to go on her own calendar.
Which becomes another issue, yeah.
But Ms. Morton, do I hear you correctly that your analysis of this case is that there could never be a situation in the justice court where we might find structural error?
I don't know if there could never be, but in this case, I don't believe that it rises to the level of a structural error. Here.
So long as the JP wishes to proceed and deny a request for a continuance, that deals with a Sixth Amendment right, we are supposed to overlook that fact and allow calendar management to outweigh certain constitutional rights.
Well, I think in this case in particular, based on what the judge's decision was, that because it was a preliminary hearing, not a trial, that it could be harmless error and that it doesn't require a reversal of the trial case. Here, Mr. Ogata had every right to substitute in afterwards, and he never did. Additionally, I think that some of this has kind of been misrepresented, where in the opening brief of the appellate on page 10, they quote from the appendix at page 116 that Ms. Tolling Pandek noted that she had encountered Mr. Ogata before court in the morning and that he again had indicated that he had retained by Mr. Patterson's mother. But the actual quote on page 116 of the appendix is, "Garrett Ogata showed up and I was advised that he had been retained by the defendant's mother to watch the trial." And if you go through page 116 and 117 of the appendix...
But that discussion and that encounter occurred before the trial and after the prelim had already occurred.
That's correct. That was okay. During the trial level.
Yeah.
And Mr. Tannery further goes on to say that, and there was discussion about this, that he doesn't think that it's Mr. Obata's intention to try to be any kind of co-counsel, and perhaps he's only been hired to observe and maybe handle an appeal if one is necessary, I don't know. But he's not here right now. And that, I think, is the point. The defendant was never denied his right to counsel at the trial level because Mr. Ogata never tried to confirm, never tried to come in on the trial, wasn't even there when the judge took the bench in the morning.
So the proposition that potentially or hypothetically with his choice of counsel below in the justice court that he might never have been bound over at all is of no consequence to you?
I don't believe that at the preliminary hearing level, whether Mr. Ogata or Mr. Tannery had been representing the defendant, that he wouldn't have been bound over. Because it is slight or marginal, it's not beyond a reasonable doubt, as in the trial level where there's many more tact decisions, you're in front of a jury. I think there is a distinction between the preliminary hearing level and the actual trial level, and all of the cases cited deal with the trial itself. They do not deal with the preliminary hearing.
Do you have any cases, counsel, that say that some level of a proceeding which has been declared to be a critical stage is the constitutional rights are not required at that level because of the burden of proof?
I do not have a case that particularly says that, Your Honor.
Okay. Are you contending that the structural error, if it was made at the justice court level, was waived by the defendant at the trial court level because he wanted to proceed with Tannery as counsel?
I think that could be, because Mr. Tannery was his attorney. He's the one who had been speaking with Mr. Tannery, and he kept Mr. Tannery throughout. Mr. Ogata hadn't been retained for the trial as trial counsel.
Was Mr. Patterson canvassed about that decision by the district court judge?
The district court judge didn't make an inquiry of the defendant, Mr. Patterson, in this case. She spoke with Ms. Panduct and Mr. Tannery, and Mr. Ogata was not present when the judge took the bench, so she didn't inquire of him. And she said that, if he shows up or if something happens later, we'll address it. But he was never there to address.
Was this discussion one of those unrecorded bench conferences that took place?
It was not, Your Honor. That's actually in the appendix at page 116 and 117 okay. is when the judge discusses that issue. I briefly wanted to go to the motion to suppress. In that issue, it also relates with the Jackson v. Deno hearing. The motion to suppress that the defendant filed was a motion in limine based on the fact that they said that there wasn't enough probable cause in the declaration of arrest to issue an arrest warrant. So when the court looked at the briefs, the defendant's brief was about a paragraph for the facts, a paragraph for the motion, and he specifically asked this court should review the warrant to determine if the affidavit for its issuance contains probable cause for the warrant. That was the extent of it that he then attached a 7-page declaration of arrest. The defense said that there wasn't probable cause to issue the arrest warrant. The state said that there was probable cause to issue the arrest warrant. So on its face, the district court was just looking at that declaration of arrest to see if there was probable cause. It's the state's contention. There's no factual dispute here. She's just looking at that, the declaration, which is different from the Sumi case and the Ruscotta case where there was a factual dispute as to what took place. And in those cases, particularly in the Ruscotta case, the court goes on to issue or to grant a motion to suppress, but states that the court's not sure from the reports whether the officers noticed the center console unfastened or when it moved, or if it moved because the officer accidentally touched it or if he unfastened anything, because the officer finds drugs and a handgun underneath the center console. So even though there were those doubts and the court didn't really know what happened, they didn't have any type of sort of a motion or a hearing. They didn't have witnesses testify. He then went on to grant that motion. However, in this case, there isn't anything other than the face of the declaration of arrest. Now, Judge Saragosa was the judge who had the preliminary hearing, but she was also just happened to be the judge who had reviewed the declaration of arrest to see if there was probable cause for the arrest warrant. So when the district court judge refers to not wanting to or didn't think that the findings of Judge Saragosa should be disturbed, she's talking about the declaration of arrest that it had probable cause for the warrant, not the preliminary hearing stage. The judge also went on to say that she didn't think that a Jackson versus Deno hearing was necessary, and that's because in the state's opposition, to be cautious, they said that, you know, that we don't believe that a Jackson v. Deno hearing is necessary. The judge agreed, and she cited the Franklin versus State. And I think in dealing with the Jackson v. Deno hearing, the defendant in this case absolutely never requested a Jackson versus Deno hearing. The defense counsel, before the FBI agent took the stand, he was allowed to ask him questions on voir dire. The defendant, after he asked him questions, he again never asked to suppress the confession, never asked for a Jackson versus Deno hearing. The defendant takes the stand, and the defendant himself, at page 946, when asked on direct about the conversations he had with the FBI agent, he says, then he's, referring to the FBI agent, it's like, okay, do you want to give us a statement? I was like, you know what, I might as well come clean and let you guys know what happened. The defendant not once claimed that his confession was involuntary or coerced. Throughout, he said that most of the things the FBI agent testified to were the exact same, outside of a few specific things where his intent came into play, where the FBI agent said the defendant told him that his intent when he grabbed the shotgun and left the apartment was to kill the victim. I see that my time is up.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Rasmussen.
Thank you.
Just to say to this has got a lot of issues, and I was wondering if, I'm not sure her time is up. She has four more minutes. Oh, it is, okay. Would you permit her to address the FBI agent's representations to the jury and the consequences
Absolutely.
Of that, please?
Ms. Morton.
The FBI agent didn't record the confession in this case. There was a jury question asking why he didn't record it. The FBI agent said it's not our policy. If you look through, although the state says that finds that the attachments of the FBI notes and emails weren't part of the record, so they shouldn't be looked at in this case. However, if you do look through that, one of the emails, quote, says, in fact, the FBI's policy is not to record unless a waiver is received from the special agent in charge. So it was the FBI's position and the agent, and what he told the state is that it's their policy not to record. In these cases, they can ask special permission, but the default policy is not to record. I don't think in this case the defendant was prejudiced by the FBI agent making this statement, and their own emails seem to back that up as well. The jury saw the defendant testify, the FBI agent testify, and I think they weighed the credibility and they made determinations on who they thought was being truthful and who they thought was not being truthful.
Further questions?
No, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Morton.
Thank you.
Ms. Rasmussen.
With regard to the FBI issue, just because it's fresh in my brain, the FBI stated, and this is in 2007, April 2007, since 1998, the heads of FBI field offices have had the discretion to allow recording on a case-by-case basis. Last year, 2006, the special agents in charge of FBI field offices were reminded in a bureau-wide memorandum that supervisors are encouraged to seek permission to record, and special agents in charge are encouraged to grant it in any case where it would further the investigation and prosecution. That is contrary to the picture that was presented at trial in this case, which is that it's not policy and we don't do it. It's just contrary. It leaves the jurors with the false impression that FBI doesn't do it. Their policy is not to do it, in fact, is the impression they leave, instead of, we're actually encouraged to, but we didn't choose to do it in this case, which really undermines the statement. And when counsel said that Mr. Patterson never argued that his statement wasn't voluntary, what he did argue was the substantial discrepancies between the statement that the FBI agent testified to and Mr. Patterson's version of events. There were substantial discrepancies with that. The recording or non-recording of the interview was a huge issue. It was absolutely on the front burner, so to speak, for the jurors.
Does that really go to the voluntariness of the statement, or is that simply a contest between the party's understanding of voluntary statements. I guess my question is there really a Deno issue here or simply a conflict in memories about what people remember of the conversation?
Your Honor, I think I would have to concede that it may not be properly characterized as a Deno issue, but the false testimony is still relevant, or the allowing of false testimony to go forward is still relevant.
Really, your argument, it seems to me, in this case is that by not being permitted to cross-examine the FBI agent about the policy, that the jury didn't get a full understanding of the credibility of that witness.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And that's because the state proffered testimony that was not accurate, allowed the agent to testify to really an inaccurate portrayal of what the policy is and the fact that they're encouraged to do it and not that they can't do it.
Well, the state may have relied on what the FBI agent told them. I don't know that the state proffered false testimony.
All right. With regard to the counsel issue, I'm going back to that. Counsel has said that it's harmless error because it occurred at the preliminary hearing. Preliminary hearing, by any account, any case law, U.S. Supreme Court, our own case law, is a critical stage in the proceedings. And again, the reason why this is structural error is because we can't go back in time. We have no way to quantify the damage or the harm. And in fact, that's what the case law says, including our case law, but Fulminante says the deprivation of the right to counsel is structural error and harmless error simply does not apply. There is no parsing of whether it's at the trial level or the preliminary hearing level. The preliminary hearing is a critical stage in the proceedings. We have a right to effective assistance of counsel at a preliminary hearing just as much as we do at a trial.
But doesn't a judge have an opportunity at least to evaluate this at the time the proceeding is taking place, if it's going to delay the proceedings and whether or not the request was made in a timely manner? I mean, it goes to the administration of justice in any particular courtroom by any particular judge.
It's true.
Yes.
And the cases where the denial of retained counsel one's choice have been upheld are few and far between, but they are where there is an absolute abuse of continuances, where people have come for the fifth trial setting, and on the eve of trial, someone now wants to substitute in. This is not such a case. It's early in the proceedings. It's at the preliminary hearing stage. Mr. Patterson was in custody. He was requesting retained counsel of choice, which means that he was willing to remain in custody longer. And there's just no canvas of him. There's no canvas at all as to, what the options are, whether the court could proceed in 2 days. The court could have bifurcated it. The court didn't want to. That doesn't necessarily outweigh the Sixth Amendment rights of the defendant, unfortunately. And the reason why it is structural error is because we can't quantify the damage. We can't quantify the damage, and the bind over occurs at this critical stage in the proceedings. The co-defendant was not bound over. So to second guess now and say Judge Saragossa was right in binding over, that's not the inquiry. That's harmless error analysis. And harmless error analysis doesn't apply to Sixth Amendment right to counsel issues.
Thank you, Ms. Rasmussen.
Thank you.
Ms. Morton, Ms. Rasmussen, thank you for your time and your attention this morning. This case stands submitted. The court will take a very brief